This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 315 was recorded on March 17th, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks, the billion-dollar alternative investment platform that lets you invest in art by legends like Warhol and Picasso for a fraction of the cost. Former Federal Reserve Open Market Operations trader Joseph Wang joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss all things Federal Reserve, from this week's rate hike to the question of whether confiscation of Russia's FX reserves will lead other central banks to cast doubt on the U.S. dollar's status as global reserve currency. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick's chart deck is titled Retracements or New Trends.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's jump straight to that S&P 500. I mean, we started the week, very weak. We were retesting the support lines of the lows throughout March. And in the last few trading sessions, and definitely the reaction after the Fed rate hike, we have a market that's bouncing pretty strong. We were 43.80 at the time of recording and definitely at a fresh week high. What's your take on this? Is it a meaningful turn?
Well, we'll see what happens, but we've got to keep in mind that the whole war is bad for the stock market is usually just the first panic reaction, and then war becomes good for the stock market after that. So we may be getting to the point where we're starting to register the war is good for the stock market, at least, even if it's bad for humanity. And that may be a part of this, Patrick, but I still think that there's a lot of challenge that lays ahead, quantitative tightening not being the least of it. So let's get into that with Joseph Wang in today's feature interview.
All right, well, let's move on to that dollar index. Certainly a short-term high seems to have been established here, but the dollar index is still trading within the trade ranges that it's been for the last 2 weeks. We're just temporarily trading below 98 level on here. Do you think this could have been a meaningful turn in the dollar with this rate hike?
Yeah, I mean, I think the war cycle is very compatible with dollar strength. It makes sense to me that we should continue to see U.S. dollar strength until we get to the point where the U.S. dollar's hegemony as the world's global reserve currency is questioned and a viable alternative is identified. And that really is the big question. Until there is a viable alternative, which there really isn't today, we're stuck with the dollar. That's just the way it is. And as long as that's the case, I think the dollar continues to appreciate. It's when we see a viable alternative, which I predict will come in the form of a digital currency, that eventually the dollar's role becomes questionable. But until then, I think it's dollar bullish as long as we have this war environment going on in the background.
All right. Well, we have to talk crude oil. What a change over a course of a week. I mean, we had obviously that peak near $130, a stone throw at least away from $130. And in the span of a week, we wiped out all the way down below $95 on the downside on an intraday basis. Here we are, crude oil's back above 100. Was that just one big strong market correction in a primary bull trend, or did something change?
Well, I think it was a market correction, but it had a very specific causality behind it. And that causality is as follows. There was a lot of institutional money long crude oil. So you got a whole bunch of traders that are long crude oil. All of a sudden, you get a blow up from 100 bucks to 130 bucks. On one hand, it's a nice profit. On the other hand, it's volatility levels that for most institutional traders, that just, you know, takes them out of the game. So they have to get out of their trade at that point. In this case, they're taking a profit, not a loss, but they still have to get out of the trade. And they can't justify putting that trade back on until you get back down to a price level where war risk or no war risk, it still makes sense to be entering the crude oil market with new money on the long side. And I think that's just what we've seen. And I think it was a buy the dip opportunity. opportunity. The one thing that makes me question whether it's really over yet is we didn't quite get the gap fill going back to the 27th of February, which was when we had that first Sunday evening gap up on the escalation of tension over in Russia. The bottom of that gap fill looks to me like, depending on how you measure it, it's either at around 92.43 or it's down at about 92.05. We never got below 93.50 on this recent correction. So it still stayed about a dollar above filling that gap. If the trader lore that all gaps are eventually filled has to come true, it means eventually we got to trade back down to $92 or so. I suppose the other way that could come out is just in the backwardation in the market. As we get into contract expiry next week, maybe that will clean up the gap for us. But aside from that, I think that the reason we got sucked so far down was that institutional money couldn't justify being in this market until you got a new entry point that made sense regardless of war risk. And that was low 90s. We got that number. I think that's the reason we saw such a big drawdown, Patrick. And I think that it's probably uphill from here, with the big caveat that filling in that gap first would make lots of sense.
Eric, how have the inventory numbers been coming in?
Well, I think, as you said last week, it's being overshadowed by bigger news on the Russia front really driving prices. But crude oil building 4.3 million barrels this week, Cushing, Oklahoma building 1.8 million barrels, gasoline drawing down 3.6 million barrels. That was the big drawdown on the board, and distillates building 322,000 barrels. U.S. production unchanged at 11.6 million barrels.
All right, well, let's talk gold, because last week we were testing the 2020 highs. I mean, we were well above 2,000 on the upside, and a very fast and quite sharp correction that was right down toward the 1,900 level on gold on the short term. Here we are trading around 1,943 at the time of recording. Again, what's going on in gold in your mind?
Well, everybody else seems to be so excited about the big breakout in gold and what it means. I'm kind of in so what mode here. I don't think, considering that gold is supposed to be the ultimate geopolitical hedge, when you get global nuclear superpowers threatening to use nuclear force against one another, which is something that actually happened last week. A week later, you know, gold's forgotten it all and it's sold off more than $100. We never even got to a new all-time high on this cycle, despite the fact that before the Russia news came out, we were fairly close to it. So I think gold continues to underperform on every imaginable front compared to what it was expected to do and what its pundits thought it was likely to do under different economic conditions. So in terms of acting as an inflation hedge or acting as a geopolitical risk hedge, I give gold a D-plus as a score, and I think there certainly have been better hedges like copper that made a lot more sense than gold in this market.
All right. Well, let's wrap up by touching on the 10-year Treasury yield, because really the yield has came back to life anyway. I mean, we ripped north of 2%. We were printing toward 2.25% on the 10-year yield, and it really looks like the bond market is starting to price in some of that inflation fears, and certainly some stress on the bond markets occurring. What's your take on this?
Well, this is definitely where it gets interesting, isn't it? You know, so many different views that we've had on Macro Voices, and I've been the first to admit that this figuring out what direction is next for the bond market is beyond my pay grade. We're starting to see the action move, and the question is, how quickly will it accelerate? Are we going to be looking at 215 this week and, you know, 220, 225 6 months from now? Or are we going to be looking at 320 or 325 6 months from now? Or is this a peak and we're headed the other way? I think it's going to be very interesting to see, but my leaning at this point is rates continuing to edge higher and inflation being more persistent than most people expect it to be.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is FedGuy.com founder Joseph Wang. Eric, why did we get Joseph on the show this week?
Patrick, Joseph is a trader who worked at the Federal Reserve on the open markets desk and has a lot of inside perspective on how things work at the Federal Reserve. So as we are approaching this quantitative tightening cycle, I wanted to get an inside expert to tell us what to expect.
Well, Eric's interview with Joseph Wang is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
Abex Technologies invites you to Smarter Markets' new podcast series, Demystifying Carbon Markets. Corporate climate pledges went mainstream in 2021. Moving into 2022, these companies are increasingly focused on developing and implementing plans to turn their climate pledges into climate action and understanding how carbon markets can help them turn their good intentions into meaningful change. For many, however, carbon markets remain unfamiliar, creating apprehension over potential risks. They have many questions. What are carbon markets? What types of projects help reduce carbon emissions? How do I judge the quality of these projects? Will the carbon markets be large enough to meet net zero goals? In this series, Smarter Markets teams up with Base Carbon Corporation to bring you the architects and practitioners of the carbon markets, seeking answers to all of these questions from people who know the markets best. Episodes are available weekly on Saturdays beginning February 5th.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Joseph Wang, proprietor of FedGuy.com. Joseph, it's great to get you on the show. This was an FOMC week. Why don't we start with what happened? I don't think the 25 basis point hike really surprised anybody, but give us the bigger picture. This is one of the most anticipated rate hikes in all of history, the beginning of a cycle that a lot of people have their eyes on. What should we take away from this week's FOMC, and what other perspective do you have on what's going on?
Hey, Eric. First of all, I want to thank you very much for inviting me. I've actually listened to Market Voices every week for the past few years, so it's a great honor to be here. So today's finning was, as you mentioned, highly anticipated. Again, we're at liftoff again. And what I see is that just we're kind of at an inflection point for global monetary policy. The Fed, for example, we're hiking today, but not just the Fed. If you look across the pond at the ECB, at the BOE, and at many developing market central banks, everyone is getting more hawkish, less accommodative. Everyone except the BOJ, but they kind of do their own thing. So today, if you look at the market reaction, you might think that it was dovish. You see equities rallied. You see the two-year yield, the one that's most sensitive to Fed policy, the rates went up a few basis points, not much, and the 10-year went up a little bit as well. But if you look at the S&P dot plot, I think what you see is, I think, a more hawkish response. You see the Fed revising up their expected Fed funds rate by 100 basis points for the next 3 years. You see inflation expectations rising and expected real growth markdown. So basically stagflationary. And the other thing that happened during the FOMC is that Powell seems to be ready to go forth with QT at the next meeting. So when you put those together, in my view, it seems like a rather hawkish meeting. Although, to be clear, inflation is very high and the Fed is far, far, far behind the curve. The way that I see this, the biggest thing that could happen in the coming weeks is that we have a very aggressive quantitative tightening, and that's actually been hinted at by Powell at his House testimony a couple weeks ago. And that, I think, could be a big change for the markets, much more so than just hiking the short rate by a couple hundred basis points would imply.
Joseph, I get a little bit concerned when I hear Jay Powell invoking references to Chairman Volcker and I forget who else. Several other people in media in the last couple of weeks have made these references to Volcker, like it's time for Volcker. And I can't help but remember one interview I saw with Chairman Volcker before he died, where he said very clearly that the aggressive hiking approach that he took in 1980 could never work today because we have a fundamentally different debt backdrop. And it's a completely different scenario, and that approach would never work. And now I hear people sounding like they're saying they're going to be like Volcker and do what he would have done, even though he already told us that that wouldn't work. Am I missing something?
Yeah, I don't think Powell is any closer to Volcker. I mean, just not too long ago, rates were at zero and we were doing QE and inflation was at 7%. That's not what Volcker would do. But I think there's a point there in high debt loads. So mechanically, what happens when you're hiking rates? What you're doing is you're reducing the value of fixed income. Now, that's really problematic when you have a very high degree of fixed income in the financial system. If you think about it, you know, treasury securities are kind of a form of money in the system. People hold them as safe assets, and it's an integral part of a lot of strategies, from risk parity to target date funds to your generic 60-40 portfolio. So when you have a very high amount of debt, a lot of it taken out at very low interest rates, there's an enormous amount of interest rate risk there. So if you even just hike rates slightly, that imposes significant amount of losses on those portfolios. In a sense, money in the system disappears. And that, I think, has tremendous financial stability and wealth effects. So we definitely have trouble hiking rates the way Volcker did, simply because the reverse wealth effect, so to speak, will be very strong and the system might become unstable. Politically, it's a difficult thing to do as well. So I think that's actually part of the reason why we don't really hike rates as much. If you think back what happened during the last hike cycle, the Fed got to a bit over 2% and the equity market melted down. When I see that though, is that's kind of the pain point for that given level of debt. And today we're at a much, much higher level of debt since then. So it stands to reason the pain point would be a little bit lower.
So where are we headed in terms of the Fed's options with all of this? It seems like people talk about Volcker as if his strategy was somehow an option, even though we know it's not. And we know that the amount of hiking that it would take to really stop inflation would result in an untenable cost of borrowing for the federal government. They'd almost bankrupt the federal government, if not outright bankrupt the federal government, by having interest rates that increase borrowing costs that much. So what are the options that are really available to the Fed?
So I would push back against that a little bit. So the federal government really isn't constrained by interest rate costs as well. It can always just roll over its debt forever, like what it's been doing the past 10 years, or if push came to shove, it could just have the Fed borrow all of it. So having high interest rate costs is not a constraint to the government at all, but it does potentially incur high inflation. What I do think, though, that the Fed could do is actually just reduce asset prices. So if you look at Federal Reserve data, the net worth of the public, it's as high as it's ever been. And that's part of what's behind the enormous amount of demand that we see everywhere. People who bought, let's say, FANG stocks, or anyone who bought a house the past few years ago, they're seeing their net worth skyrocket. That gives them money to go and buy other things, which increases demand. The irony is that if you think back to what happened during the post-GFC world, the Fed began trying to stimulate a wealth effect to try to boost growth and inflation. It knew that it could not give money directly to the people, so it thought that maybe if it could force an asset bubble to get people to spend more because they felt wealthier, that might improve the economic conditions. Now, having the wealth effect as part of their toolkit, it seems, though, it's become a very important part of it, and they should probably just deploy it again, but in reverse. By hiking the interest rates, the Fed funds rate, by 100 or 200 basis points, it's hard for me to see how that actually fills into the real economy. I can't think of anyone who would really change their buying or selling decisions in the real economy from just purely on 100 or 200 basis points. But it would affect the financial markets a lot. And maybe that's the primary channel that the Fed actually acts now.
Joseph, you studied all of these cycles. Walk us through what a quantitative tightening cycle should look like. What should we expect from it? And particularly, how did this go last time when it was supposed to be a quantitative tightening cycle? Then after a certain point, we got to the so-called Powell pivot where it was, well, it was going to be a tightening cycle, but we changed our mind. Should we be watching for that kind of reversal again? And what would be the signs that it's coming?
Well, the Fed has a history of hiking till things break, so that's probably what we should watch. But so you're right. I was on the Fed's trading desk at the time during quantitative easing, and I studied this quite a lot. So when you're on the Fed's trading desk, you have access to basically everyone's reserve account. You can talk to the treasury teams of banks. You survey them and talk to the dealers. So you get a very good sense of just how the mechanics of quantitative tightening works. So just as a big picture, the way that you can think about this is that, so quantitative easing increased the level of reserve assets and deposit liabilities in the banking system. And from the non-bank's perspective, decreased the amount of, say, treasuries and increased the amount of bank deposits. And quantitative tightening will reverse all that. So banks will have fewer reserves and deposit liabilities, and non-banks will have fewer deposits and more treasuries. So I guess just as a, just by way of background, it's important to understand that we have a two-tiered monetary system where people who can bank at the Fed, they hold reserves as money. And people who can't bank at the Fed, so let's say me, you, or any other investor, we held bank deposits as money. And these two systems interact. For example, if you're an investor and you're selling a treasury to the Fed, what happens is that the Fed sends reserves to your bank, since the Fed deals in reserves. And since you don't have a reserve account, then the bank turns around and credits deposits to you. So at the end of the day, instead of holding treasuries, you hold some bank deposits, and your bank will have more reserve assets and deposit liabilities. And that's basically what QE does. And QT reverses all of that. So it will reduce the cash balances of banks, which is reserves. And for the private sector, it increases the amount of duration that they hold. But exactly how that impacts markets, though, it's not really dependent upon the Fed. It's going to be dependent upon how the U.S. Treasury reacts. So the big impact of QT back in the last cycle, when things blew up, really had to do with what happened during the banking sector when their reserve balances declined. So as I mentioned before, QT shrinks the cash balances of banks and increases the duration held by non-banks. So back during the prior QT episode, banks were taking all their excess cash and they were investing in repo. So there was insatiable demand for repo financing. And you can see that in public data. So repo volumes were rising, pushing repo rates above interest on reserves. Banks saw that, you know, they could earn an extra return by investing in repo. And under the regulations, repo and reserves were fungible. They began lending into repo and became the marginal lender. QT basically shrank their cash balances such that there's less money going to the repo market until kind of hit an air pocket and repo rates spiked. This time around, though, the impact is the banks are behaving very differently. They're not investing in their marginal dollars into repo. They're buying treasuries and agency MBS. And so what would happen from QT, at least in that mechanism, would suggest higher rates rather than anything to do with repo at all. But just moving on to the non-bank side, the amount of duration the private sector has to bear, I say that's a decision by Treasury because it's Treasury decides what issuance would be. So mechanically, what happens is the Treasury is going to issue new debt and take the proceeds from that debt to repay the Treasuries held at the Fed. So someone in the private sector is basically going to refinance the debt that's currently held at the Fed. Treasury has discretion as to where along the curve they can issue. They can issue 5, 10s, bills, and so forth. And that, I think, is going to be the biggest determinant in what happens to private sector duration. If the Treasury decided to issue a whole bunch of bills, that would just take money out of the RRP facility, and it would have very little impact on interest rates. Or the Treasury could take advantage of historically low interest rates, issue a whole bunch in the longer-dated Treasuries, and that would put upward pressure along the curve.
I know that you're a regular listener, Joseph. I'm sure you heard Charlie McElligott's interview a couple of weeks ago where he told us that in these tightening cycles, history teaches us a couple of months in, which would suggest May or so, would be about where you would expect a bottom in equity markets. First of all, do you agree with Charlie's outlook that there is likely to be some weakness in equity markets as a result of QT? And if so, is May sound about right? How does your outlook compare with Charlie's?
I absolutely agree. So mechanically, Charlie McElligott is a master in options markets. I see things from the mechanics of the monetary system. So mechanically, what happens during quantitative easing is that you take treasuries out of the system and add bank deposits, but the two are not perfectly substitutable forms of money. Bank deposits are not free of credit risk, and they're zero yielding. So if you're someone who needs yield, you're going to have to buy something else, maybe a corporate bond, maybe even equity, maybe further out the curve. And if you're someone who can't take credit risk, you're going to have to buy a longer dated treasury or maybe an agency MBS. QT reverses all of that. It takes out bank deposits. So the quantity of zero yielding credit, bank credit risk, deposits declines, less of it needs to find a home, and there's more safe assets to buy. And so that's very negative for all risk assets. You can think of, if QE was good for the risk assets, QT logically is not good. So I think that that's exactly right. Once we have the more contours of QT, that should mechanically be a tailwind for risk assets. But there's other things to keep in mind as well. We appear to be in an inflationary cycle, in my view, largely driven by deficit spending. When you think of what the Treasury is doing when they're deficit spending, is they're buying goods and services, but they're paying by printing Treasury securities. I contend that Treasury securities are basically a form of money. So if you think about it, if you go to a restaurant, you can't buy... Let's say you can buy dinner with a 10-year note, but a 10-year note can easily be liquidated either in the deepest cash market in the world or the trillion-dollar overnight repo market. If you think that a $100 bill issued by the government is money, then you know a $100 10-year note is basically just money that pays interest. Now, from this perspective, every year the federal government is printing, you know, $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion of money to fund its spending. That's inflationary and that's risk positive. So in the long run, we can have these corrections, but as long as that deficit spigot keeps flowing, it's hard to see risk assets or actually all assets do anything but go up.
Joseph, last time that we went through this, the Fed kind of changed course when the markets, as you put it, broke. Would you expect that to happen again, that we're going to see the Fed stay on this course until something breaks? And how long do you think it takes before something breaks?
Yeah, the Fed always stays on course until it breaks. So
how long does it take to break it this time?
I'll lay out some numbers for you, and maybe that could help give you a concept of what's happening. So again, what QT is doing is increasing the amount of duration, amount of longer dated debt, risk-free assets, agency MBS or treasuries that the private sector has to absorb. Powell noted in his congressional testimony a couple weeks ago that he was expecting QT to take about 3 years to get the balance sheet back to normal. Generously thinking, let's say the balance sheet is $9 trillion now, let's say $6 trillion is normal. this is a conservative estimate. It could easily be $5 trillion. So if you're thinking we'd have to shrink $3 trillion in 3 years, then that's about $1 trillion a year, which means the private sector is going to have to absorb $1 trillion a year in duration. And on top of that, we have the Treasury itself forecasting about $1.5 trillion in net new issuance this year and next year and the year after that. So the private sector is going to have to absorb a historic amount of duration. That means rates, long-dated rates, mechanically, just by supply and demand, are very likely to go higher. And through the mechanism that I discussed earlier, so risk parity strategies, for example, target date funds, when you have the bond market sell off, risk assets have to sell off as well because they're linked by these strategies. So I'm not sure exactly, but I would be surprised if we got through a year of QT without someone breaking, possibly something, let's say, in the belly or longer end of the curve that would force a rethink of what the Fed is doing.
Joseph, let's talk about the securities that are being purchased. Everybody assumes it's Treasury securities, T-bonds, T-notes, and so forth, but it actually also includes mortgage-backed securities, doesn't it?
Yeah. That's actually an important part of what happens too. So the MBS portfolio is going to roll off a little bit differently than the Treasuries. The way that a Treasury rolls off, like I mentioned earlier, the U.S. Treasury issues new debt to a private sector investor and takes the proceeds of that to repay the Fed. But here, usually what happens is that the mortgages that the Fed holds, it can either repay it by just normal principal and interest payments over a 30-year term, or it can be repaid if the mortgage borrower either refinances their mortgage or buys a new house. In the U.S., mortgages are prepayable. So if you have a 5% interest rate mortgage rates drop 1% to 4%, you can take out a new mortgage loan to repay that old mortgage. That's one way the Fed could be repaid. Another way is if you have a house and you decide to sell your house, then at that moment, when you sell the house, the proceeds of that sale are used to repay the mortgages that's held by the Fed. Now, in the current context, what's going to happen is that because so many of the mortgages were taken out when interest rates at generationally low levels, they're unlikely to repay, and the people who bought houses are unlikely going to give up their historically low mortgage rates. So the only way that the Fed is going to be able to roll off its mortgage portfolio is either to wait patiently or to actually start selling their agency MBS portfolio. That's been mentioned by a few Fed presidents. At the moment, the projections by the Fed are an agency MBS portfolio that gets paid down at a rate about $25 billion a month. So it's not super slow, but eventually you might have to sell a little bit if you want to hit that $3 trillion in 3 year target. This matters because, as Jay Powell once noted before, the Fed buying agency MBS, in a sense, it's shorting volatility. Since owning an agency MBS, you're selling a call option since the MBS can be prepaid. Now, if a private sector investor holds it, they might want to hedge that convexity. So usually that means more volatility in the rates market. If you think back to what things were like pre-GFC, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had investment mortgage portfolios together about $1.5 trillion. So that meant that when rates went higher, they had to hedge by selling treasuries. Since when rates went higher, if they wanted to maintain their current duration, they'd have to go short. Since when the rates went higher, that meant that there would be fewer prepayments. And if rates went lower, that means there'd be more prepayments, duration would shorter, and they'd also have to buy treasuries or treasury futures or stretch through options to maintain their current duration. So that itself exacerbates rate fall. And if you look at the MOVE index, you can kind of see rate fall ticking higher as well. So in the future, you might not just have higher interest rates, but you could also have more volatile interest rates.
Joseph, as you know, the entire world's financial system really centers around U.S. Treasury bonds as financial reserve assets. That's essentially the piggy bank, if you will, for a central bank, an entire country's piggy bank. What is it going to mean if we have changed the rules through the recent news events? And I know you wrote an article about this on your website called Breaking the System, which I recommend to our readers. What is it going to mean if we kind of find out that, well, the rules of this game are that all the sovereign nations are equal on the same footing, except the United States gets to cancel anybody's foreign exchange reserves if they're upset with them. And clearly, the U.S. had very good reason to be upset with Russia recently. But essentially, without any due process of law, without any court judgment, without any decision from a judge or a jury, the United States decided that Russia doesn't have its foreign reserve assets anymore. Essentially, used some, as I understand it, some Federal Reserve computer trickery to make that money go away. What are the long-term implications of this on the rest of the financial system? Particularly, I have to imagine that other central bankers are thinking, hey, wait a minute, what if I ever get in the Fed's bad graces? Does that mean they're going to cancel our reserves as well? Are there credibility issues for the viability of the U.S. dollar as the world's global reserve currency if the U.S. government is going to have this ability to kind of undo people's savings when they want to?
Eric, I think you're exactly right. And what the U.S. government did, not just the U.S., the European Union as well, was tremendously dangerous. And we're seeing it not just happen in the sovereign space, but on the retail space as well. If you look at what happened in Canada, Prime Minister Trudeau basically unbanked everyone who dissented. So what we're seeing globally is a worldwide weaponization of the banking system. And that's extremely, extremely dangerous because the banking system fundamentally rests on trust. You have money, you're giving it to a complete stranger you don't know at all, and all you see as proof are numbers on a computer screen. That's as true for the retail depositor as it is for a sovereign investor. All they see are, say, digits, probably not at the Fed, but at some other European central bank. So if you think that this is weaponized, then fundamentally what you thought was risk-free is no longer risk-free. And if this isn't risk-free, then if you're a sovereign investor or any conservative investor, you can't put a lot of value in it. You can't hold it. So I think this has tremendous damage to the banking system, but I'm not sure that it spells the demise of the U.S. dollar. So I would say that the two can coexist. You can have a great decline of confidence in the financial system, but you can still have the dollar remain preeminent. The truth is, the world runs on dollars. The dollar is the currency of global trade. So internationally, about half of all transactions in trade is invoiced in dollars. That's not just trade with the U.S. The U.S. actually is not that big in global trade. It's trade between non-U.S. parties. So if you are, let's say, an Indonesian firm buying from a Vietnamese firm, often things would be invoiced in dollars. And if you look at the FX space, about the vast majority of FX pairs are against the dollar. So you're going to need dollars just for day-to-day transactions for global trade, even if you don't have confidence in it. But what could change, though, is where you store your, let's say, foreign reserves or your safe assets. Because let's look at China, for example. It has $3.5 trillion in foreign reserves. It definitely does not need to have all that to trade with the world. So there's no reason it needs to hold a lot of it in foreign currency. And that's true for any sovereign. So what I think you could see is just a massive reshuffling of foreign reserve holdings such that sovereigns hold fewer foreign currencies and more dollars. And you can even think of this as a national security issue. So if you're a foreign sovereign, be it China, be it India or Russia, and you want to be able to conduct your foreign policy without being threatened by anyone, you want to be a sovereign state, then you kind of have to be able to survive a confiscation of your foreign assets. If you think back to what happened during World War II, the U.S. showed the world that they had nuclear weapons, and everyone was scared, even the U.S.'s allies. And even their allies wanted to have nuclear weapons. Why? Well, just in case. It's a national security issue. I think you can see the same thing happen for all the foreign reserve managers in the world after seeing what happened with Russia. It's not that they're not friends with the U.S. or that they don't need dollars, but they don't need as much. And there's a national security issue to be able to survive a confiscation just in case.
Now, you say that everyone needs dollars, but the question on my mind is, why is that still true and how long is that going to stay true? And specifically, the question I want to ask you is, who outside the United States is left who still thinks that the U.S. dollar being the global reserve currency at the center of the financial system for the rest of the world is a good thing? Certainly, I see the many reasons that it benefits the United States government for that to continue to be true. But who outside the U.S. still favors that? And how long will it take for them to come up with an alternative to the U.S. dollar, which it seems like they've been incentivized to work on, if we continue to have policies that I think are alienating to some foreign investors?
So we see whispers of alternatives to the dollar. I saw an article where Russia is trading with India using non-dollars. And of course, China and Russia both have interbank payment systems that they're trying to get together and set up. But the truth is, there's no real alternative. If you look at China, for example, which many people think of as maybe one day creating a system that rivals the dollar, having a global currency entails giving up some sovereign power. For example, you're going to have rule of law. So foreign investors are going to have to be treated equally than local investors, even if the local investor is a very important member of the government. And foreign investors who put money into your currency need to be able to A, park it in something that's deep and liquid, and B, being able to take it out whenever they want. So that means no capital controls. Now, if you do this as a government, you kind of are ceding some power. You can't treat your own people, your friends, better than other people. And you can't just shut it all down to prevent financial panics. So that's kind of losing a policy lever as well. So there are benefits and costs, and just looking at, you know, some governments out there, I don't think they're ready to do that yet. Another alternative could be something like the European Union. But if you look at how the euro has been doing the past few decades, it doesn't seem to be gaining steam as a global reserve currency. It seems very much to be a huge regional currency. Something interesting to note, during the March 2020 pandemic, we had a huge scramble for dollars. The Fed rolled out the FX swap lines with take up almost half $1 trillion. The ECB also rolled out Euro FX swap lines with take up about $1 billion. So it's very clear that it's not a global currency. So Eric, just looking across the world, there's no one that could replace the dollar. And I don't see that happening any soon. But that doesn't mean people could diversify out of the dollar. They could still, as I mentioned, you can have the dollar system remain, but have it weakened and have people diversify into, say, gold, which central banks are historically comfortable with.
Well, Joseph, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Before I let you go, though, please tell our listeners a little bit more about FedGuy.com. You were a trader for the Federal Reserve in New York. How did your departure from the Fed come apart, and why are you taking it upon yourself to educate people about central banking now?
So I think of working in as just a learning process. Fed is a great place to learn, and I felt like I had learned all that I had, all there was to learn there. And so I left, and now I write this blog. I teach people about what's happening in the financial system. I help people learn about it. I have a book, Central Banking 101, that goes into more depth about how the Fed works, monetary system works. And I also have a few online courses on my website for those who are more interested in a more deep dive on secured money markets like repo and the Fed's balance sheet.
And that's all at fedguy.com. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Feeling like you've hit a wall with your investment strategy? Or maybe you've been burned by the stock market too many times since the start of the pandemic? What if I told you that you could invest in a resilient alternative asset class that the elite have been quietly putting their money into for centuries? I'm talking about blue chip works of art. Artwork that's outpaced the S&P 500 from 1995 through 2020. And while it used to be inaccessible to the everyday investor, that's no longer the case. Masterworks is the billion-dollar startup securitizing the once-exclusive art market, allowing you to finally add iconic paintings from masters like Banksy, Picasso, and Basquiat to your portfolio at a fraction of the cost. And right now, Masterworks is giving my listeners priority access for their newest offerings. Start putting your money to work at masterworks.art/macrovoices. Again, that's masterworks.art/macrovoices. See important disclaimers at masterworks.io/disclaimer.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Well, Eric, it was great to have Joseph on the show. You know, it is really interesting to see how Powell came out and really, stood the ground that a rate hike cycle is underway and they're going to stay the course. And it really does feel like there's going to be a situation where there could be policy error, or, you know, they're going to keep going till something breaks. It's going to really be interesting how it all plays out.
Well, spoken like a true insider, Joseph told the whole story. The Fed's going to continue doing what they're doing until they break something, and then they'll start doing something different. That's the way governments tend to work. Let's move on to our post-game chart book, which this week is titled Retracements or New Trends. Listeners, you find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, what is it, retracement or a new trend?
Well, isn't that the single biggest puzzle piece to solve right now? I mean, we heard Charlie and others talk about this idea that we could have markets that remain weak for even several more months before putting in a bottom. But we're at a really interesting moment where we have met all the criteria of a market correction. We've been correcting, 15%+. It's been several months of market correction. Typically, markets get oversold enough, especially if you think about all the headlines that could have caused the market to have a liquidity event to the downside, and it didn't happen. And so there's an increasing chance that there's going to be some sort of counter trend rally. But we're coming to the real important pivot. If that 4,400 level, while here it's a convergence of both the 200-day and the 50-day moving average, it's also the Fib retracement of the last drop, as well as where there's a gamma flip zone sitting right in there. So many levels right in this pocket. And we certainly have seen the first reaction be up on the Fed. But what will be interesting to see is whether or not the bulls have the gas in the tank to punch the 4,400 level on the upside. I think really above there, we can start to approach this market in a much more neutral manner. I don't know how bullish I want to be the market, but certainly a breakup of 4,400 would mean that there's going to potentially be more upside follow through and a lot of relief from a very oversold state. And so I'll be watching that very closely going into next week.
Let's move on to currencies. On page 3, we've got the Euro-US dollar cross.
Yeah, well, we talked about the dollar and the current pullback, and what we had was a pretty oversold euro that was pretty much driving the dollar strength. And we're seeing the euro getting a much-needed bounce, coming up toward its retracement zones, and that 50-day moving average also lying around that 112 level. There was a substantial consolidation of the euro in the 112 to 113 zone, and that's kind of like a fair value zone that's been establishing a base. Often, when trends are in play, that those levels become resistance. And so while the euro very much is likely to strengthen towards 112, what it does as it approaches that level is going to be the big tell. If the primary US dollar bull trend is intact, then the euro should have a very hard time beating those levels. And if we see signs next week that it's rolling over, then it'd be a little early or premature to write off the dollar. But on page four, we have that US dollar Japanese yen chart. And really, the US dollar has been actually in a big trade range against the yen for a better part of 6 months. And it was last week that we actually saw a bullish US dollar breakout out of from the yen at that level. And that again is just creates a little more further confusion amongst all the major cross currencies as to what will the prevailing dollar trend be. I mean, it really looks like one big mess, and it may take weeks to really determine if the dollar bull trend can continue here.
Patrick, let's move on to page five, where we've got the gold futures chart. Is it put a bottom in, or we headed back up, or is that just a little dead cat?
Well, I know you've shared at the market wrap your disappointment in gold's reaction overall, but I'm not so sure I'm ready to take your view. I think that after a very long and extended basing formation, gold is just starting to show signs of coming to life, and the more it works, the more likely it is that more money flow will keep coming here. So I'm not ready to take a negative view on here, but what is interesting is that whenever you have a big meaningful breakout like this, what usually happens is all of the previous highs act like support. And you can see as that 50-day moving average is coming in toward 1900 and all those previous highs that rejected near 1900 over the course of last year, we're going to get a real big tell. If gold is going to remain bullish, it will hold the line here. And we shouldn't see any price action on any sustained basis below 1900. And so I think that watching here as to whether this was just a quick little profit-taking washout, if the bulls can quickly get this north of 2,000 by next week, there's still room for 2,100, 2,200 on the upside. And once gold, if the circumstances are there, that gold makes 52-week new highs, I think it will start getting a lot of press, and that in itself could drive further money flow. But Eric, I want to move on to page six, where I have that crude oil chart. And I know we were just talking about this even before we started recording, just in terms of what's next here for crude. And while it was an incredibly violent market correction, $30+ in a span of a week on the downside, in the bigger context, there's a primary uptrend, and we've basically given back half of the gains that were made in the oil advance. Arguably, if oil here is able to hold the line, particularly in my mind, get above levels around 110, 115, if we can get back above there, then I still think that the primary trend may still be higher moves. But here, at least a bounce toward 110 is likely. But a lot of really interesting things that could potentially develop here. What levels are you watching on oil?
Patrick, I think the chart on page six gives us a great visual reference for this, because if you look at that chart, you can see from the beginning of 2022 to the 1st of March, there's a nice, steady rally. And my expectation before the whole Russia tension came up had been that that would continue on approximately that trajectory. And if you just visually extend that, you can see that it moves up above $100 and continues substantially higher than that. I wouldn't be surprised by the time of the summer is over if we had challenged the $147 previous all-time high set back in 2008. Then we had this great big bubble up in reaction to the first wave of Russia and Ukraine tension. First of all, we had people a week ago threatening to use nuclear force against one another. I think the biggest geopolitical risk moment since the Cuban Missile Crisis just happened last week, and now everybody's acting like, okay, it's over, we've forgotten about it. I think that was just the first round. So first of all, I think we're back down, or we were back down when we hit the low 90s over the last couple of days. We got back down to where the existing trend line should have been before this whole Russia tension came in. That gave justification for institutional longs to start to get back into the market. And I think that it's going to be a continued slow grind higher from here, punctuated by sudden spikes much higher very quickly if we get more tension in the geopolitical space, which I think is quite likely. So I think there's plenty of room to make an argument for modest upside from here or huge upside, depending on what happens geopolitically.
All right. Well, listen, I wanted to just highlight on page 7 here with uranium. And what's interesting is whether it was gold, whether it was oil, or whether it's uranium, what we had was very strong breakouts. And the last week defined a very deep and meaningful market correction of that trend. You can see in the same manner, we've got a correction coming back to some key support lines, approaching those moving averages. And it'll be really interesting to see whether all of these commodities behave in the same manner. I don't have the chart here of wheat or other commodities, but many of them have done the same thing over the past week. And so every rally tends to be checked. There's always profit-taking cycles. There's always little squeezes to wash out weak hands and all sorts of types of price behavior that is characteristic of markets. But after this type of a market correction, it'll be so curious whether all of these commodities can put together a rally into next week.
Patrick, let's move on to page 8, where we've got the Chinese A50 stock index. Why are we looking at Chinese equities suddenly?
Well, what was interesting was that really going into the start of this week, China really accelerated to the downside. Their stock market was actually just almost started an outright plunge. I mean, we were down, 20% almost in a span of just 2 weeks on the China A50. And it really looked like that things were sort of unraveling there. And then came in whatever it takes moment. It seems that some people have been suggesting with China wanting to do an intervention. And it led to a pretty solid and meaningful turnaround, one-day turnaround. And one of the things that I'm going to be very curious about into next week and what I'm going to be watching is whether the market participants buy it and whether that was enough to put in a bottom and a trend reversal in China, or whether this was just an oversold condition that was just due for one of these types of reactions and the selling will ensue again. There's obviously a catalyst now for a turn. It'll be really interesting to see whether the bulls can follow through on this and start to meaningfully turn this trend.
Patrick, on the next several slides, there's a sequence of charts which are all the sector ETFs. What are they telling us?
Yeah, I just really wanted to kind of have a conversation about what's happening under the hood in terms of which parts of the markets are moving and not. What was really interesting is that over the last month, really some heavier selling came in the U.S. financial sector. And what's really interesting is the last few days have seen a pretty significant and meaningful bounce there. And one of the things that I'm going to be watching here is whether the financials really did begin a new sequence of a downtrend that could potentially be the market that continues to drive potential corrections. Like we were saying, Charlie and Joseph and others were talking about the potential for weakness going in for several more months to the downside of equities. One of the things that you'll see is that we would see in those circumstances where financials on these types of bounces would fail right here as they approach these retracement zones and these moving averages. Be really interesting to see whether or not they roll over and sell again, or whether or not they come right back into their trade ranges. And it's certainly one of the one markets I think is worth watching. Another interesting thing to observe is on page 10, where we have the healthcare ETF. We've seen a lot of the biotechs and healthcares doing very poorly during this whole market correction. And what it seems to be is money is now finding a lot of these defensive sectors, whether it's this healthcare sector now trading almost two-month highs, breaking and reversing on the upside. But even if you take the utilities index on page 12, what we're seeing is a lot of those most defensive parts of the market actually getting a certain amount of this money flow. And the question is, can we have a bigger or more meaningful stock market rally when the leadership is actually the defensive sectors rather than the growth sectors? And I don't know. To me, it's a bit of a red flag, and it's one of those things where I'd want to see to have a high conviction on the whole market. I'd want to see the more broader participation beyond these defensives. On page 11, just circling back here, the interesting thing was that as this Russia escalation occurred, that aerospace and defense sector initially took a very bullish breakout, heading right back to 52-week highs, but it's really stalled out and retraced, looking very similar to a lot of the commodity charts that we have had on and before. And will be really interesting to see whether the new global defense spending causes a bullish run in this aerospace defense sector. One of the interesting things for me is that it should really hold the line where we put in those lows around 105. If this is a level where this place turns, it'll be interesting to see whether they can attempt 52-week highs later this week. But the one I wanted to finally just wrap up with here is just looking at the gold miners on page 13. So the interesting thing, Eric, here about the gold miners ETF is that while gold and silver have had relatively deep pullbacks, what is particularly interesting is that many of the gold miners have actually for once held up and dug in. And it's interesting that we're almost back to the trade ranges where gold miners were consolidating near this kind of 38, 39 level just a week ago. And so what's interesting is that even though gold itself has pulled back, these gold miners seem to be getting a lot of attention here. And it'll be really interesting to see whether they'll be able to hold this new bull trend going into that window.
Listeners, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. You can find the information on page 15 or at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks, the billion-dollar alternative investment platform that lets you invest in art by legends like Warhol and Picasso for a fraction of the cost. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed in this post game, as well as a number of links to articles we found really interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend, that's Eric spelled with a K, and myself, @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.